From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Those commissioners voting in favor of the item signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed signify. The item is adopted. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.
Over the cries of protesters, the FCC votes to scrap or overhaul decades-old media rules, likely unleashing the largest wave of corporate media consolidation in U.S. history. We will also speak with the nurse who is the victim of the Women's Health Clinic bombing that Eric Rudolph is accused of committing. Eric Rudolph has been moved from Asheville, North Carolina to Birmingham, Alabama to stand charges for a series of bombings. All that and more coming up. Despite fierce opposition, the Federal Communications Commission yesterday voted by a majority of one to eliminate or overhaul decades-old rules governing media consolidation. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The changes will unleash a major new wave of consolidation among newspaper, television, and radio companies. More on that story in a minute. We'll be joined by one of the dissident commissioners who has held forum around the country calling for a delay of this overhaul. President George Bush has begun meeting with Arab leaders in Egypt, including the new Palestinian prime minister. Until now, Bush has avoided a personal role in the Mideast peace process since so many U.S. presidents have failed in their attempts to broker peace. Secretary of State General Colin Powell is also in Egypt for the talks. One of the Bush administration's main goals is to secure Arab support for the new Palestinian prime minister. Abu Mazen was installed after Israel and the U.S. refused to deal with Yasser Arafat. The Egyptian foreign minister said Arab leaders will ask Bush for a firm commitment to the implementation of the U.S.-backed so-called roadmap to peace. Arab leaders also want an end to Israeli invasions of Palestinian territory, assassinations, and house demolitions. This morning, Israel began releasing about 100 Palestinian prisoners. But yesterday, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported that the prime minister, Ariel Sharon, has rejected a request from the White House to declare an end to the occupation. The BBC is reporting Israeli soldiers shot and killed a Palestinian policeman in northern Gaza. Bush travels to Jordan tomorrow to hold his first summit with the Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers. The G8 summit in Evian, France, came to a close today. Leaders from the seven richest nations in the world, plus Russia, issued an evasive closing statement which declared, quote, our shared objective is a fully sovereign, stable, and democratic Iraq. Last night at a dinner, the leaders discussed a highly critical document prepared at an alternative summit last week by 1,000 activists against corporate globalization. That document included calls for full debt relief for the nation's poorest countries, the enforcement of labor rights, and the creation of international rules to curb pollution. Bush missed the discussion. He'd left already for the Middle East. None of the recommendations made it into the final official document. Outside the luxury hotel overlooking Lake Geneva, where the leaders met, beyond 25,000 police and a steel fence, protests continued overnight. Police used water cannons, rubber bullets, and tear gas on hundreds of demonstrators. All of this comes as France is facing a massive strike involving nearly all sectors of civil service. The staff of most of the national rail system last night began 2 days of work stoppages. Air traffic controllers have scheduled 3 days of stoppages. Postal workers have called for an indefinite strike, and teachers have been protesting for nearly 2 months the government's attempt to overhaul their retirement plans. Mass marches are scheduled for today, and workers in the steel, car, and banking industries will join in. The London Guardian notes a conflict of similar proportions in 1995. brought down the French government. Austria is in the middle of its largest strike since World War II. Buses, trains, trams, and the underground rail network went operation shortly after midnight last night. As in France, workers are protesting the government's plan to cut their retirement benefits. In Germany, thousands of steel and engineering workers are expected to go on strike on Thursday. In Italy, airline workers forced a major airline to cancel 200 flights today. And much further south in Zimbabwe, the anti-government strikes continue today. Opposition officials are vowing to continue despite a violent crackdown by police and troops. Yesterday, soldiers in armored vehicles fired live bullets and tear gas at protesters in the capital, Harare. Banks and most businesses are closed. Here in this country, a Justice Department report released yesterday concluded authorities violated the civil rights of hundreds of immigrants detained after the September 11th attacks. At a federal prison where over 80 people were held, there was a, quote, pattern of physical and verbal abuse. The review by the Office of the Inspector General also found FBI officials made little attempt to distinguish between immigrants with possible ties to terrorism and those who simply had the misfortune of being swept up in the investigation. Without bail, detainees remain in jail for an average of nearly 3 months. They had to wait for weeks until they were allowed to make phone calls and find lawyers. Some were kept for months in cells illuminated 24 hours a day and were escorted in handcuffs, leg irons, and waist chains. The Senate Armed Services Committee has announced it'll investigate whether the Bush administration used faulty intelligence information about alleged weapons of mass destruction in Iraq in order to justify the invasion. The investigation is backed by both Republican and Democratic politicians. Virginia Republican John Warner, who heads the committee, said, quote, "The situation is becoming one where the credibility of the administration and Congress is being challenged." The top Democrat on the House of Representatives Government Reform Committee, California Democrat Henry Waxman, wrote to Bush saying, "To date, you have offered no explanation as to why you and your most senior advisors made repeated allegations based on forged documents." The BBC reports the inquiry will include public hearings that will be televised live. The General Accounting Office yesterday asked Congress to recommend the Pentagon triple its most recent estimate of the number of troops exposed to radioactive chemicals during the Gulf War demolition of sarin gas stockpile in Qamishli, Iraq. This comes after analysts concluded the Pentagon was using flawed science when it calculated its estimates. The Pentagon originally estimated no soldiers were exposed. Then in 1996, it said 400 were exposed. And in 1997, the Pentagon increased the number to 100,000. Now the GAO says some 350,000 troops should be presumed exposed, roughly half the U.S. forces that served in the first Persian Gulf War. And the UN mission in the Congo has confirmed reports of fresh fighting in the mineral-rich Ituri province. This after a spokesperson for an armed faction said yesterday nearly 350 people, mostly civilians, were killed in a weekend massacre in Ituri. The spokesperson also said government troops were involved in the slaughter. But UN officials told the AFP they can't confirm civilians were killed, and it's unlikely they will conduct an investigation because they don't have the necessary human resources. Secretary General Kofi Annan yesterday called for the tripling of the number of peacekeeping forces there.
Down, I am floating away into the ocean skies over my hometown. Day. What is it about Birmingham? What is it about Buffalo that the hate-filled wanna build bunkers in your beautiful red earth? They wanna build them in our shiny white snow. And now I've drawn close the so powerless in this stupid booth with this useless little lever in my hand. And outside, my city is bracing for the next killing thing, standing by the bridge and praying for the next Dr. Martin Luther.
Hello, Birmingham. Ani DeFranco. In the second half of the show, we will speak with the nurse who was blown up in the bombing of a women's health clinic in Birmingham, Alabama. Eric Rudolph has been charged in that bombing. He has now been brought to Birmingham, Alabama to stand trial. But first, we turn to the historic event that took place yesterday in Washington, D.C. Despite fierce opposition, a sharply divided Federal Communications Commission yesterday approved an overhaul of the limits on how much media companies are allowed to own. Opponents warning of the dangers of extreme media concentration for news gathering and entertainment vowed to fight in the courts and Congress to overturn the new rules, which the FCC approved in a 3-2 party line vote. In the biggest markets like New York and Los Angeles, the new rules allow a single company to own up to 3 local television stations for the first time and to own both a newspaper and TV station. The rules also expand the number of markets in which an owner can have up to 2 stations. First, let's go to the meeting that was held yesterday in Washington, D.C. We turn to FCC Chair Michael Powell.
Today, we complete the most exhaustive and comprehensive review of broadcast ownership rules ever undertaken. We have done so obligated by our statutory duty to review the rules biannually and prove those rules are necessary in the public interest. The Court of Appeals has interpreted this standard as placing a high hurdle before the Commission for maintaining a given regulation, and made quite clear that failure to surmount that hurdle based on a thorough record must result in the rule's modification or elimination. This is an exceedingly difficult charge, but a critical one to fulfill if we hope to continue to promote the cherished values of diversity, localism, and competition. Over the past 20 months, we have been working tirelessly towards achieving 3 critical important goals. The first, reinstating legally enforceable broadcast ownership limits that promote diversity, localism, and competition, replacing those that have been struck down by the courts. 2, building modern rules that take proper account of the explosion of new media outlets for news, information, and entertainment, rather than perpetuate the graying rules of a bygone black and white era. And 3, striking a careful balance that does not unduly limit transactions that promote the public interest while ensuring that no company can monopolize the medium. I am confident we succeed by today's order. This proceeding has been the subject of extraordinary public attention. To my mind, it is right that it has been so, for the values these rules are intended to advance are critically important to a vibrant democracy. I have heard the concerns expressed by the public about excessive consolidation. Though such generalized worries do not clearly suggest specific answers to the specific issues the Commission must address, they have introduced a note of caution in the choices we have made. Consequently, our decisions today, retaining the rule against networks merging, tightening the limits on radio ownership, and modifying rather than eliminating the remaining rules, are modest, albeit very significant, changes. But I must punctuate one irreducible point. Keeping the rules exactly as they are, as some so stridently suggest, was not a viable option. Without today's surgery, the rules would assuredly meet a swift death. As the only member of this commission here during the last biennial review, I watched firsthand as we bent to political pressure and left many rules unchanged. Nearly all were rejected by the court because of our failure to apply the statute faithfully. I have been committed to not repeating that error, for I believe the stakes are perilously high. Leaving things unaltered, regardless of any change in the competitive landscape, is a course that only Congress can legitimately chart. For these reasons, we have embraced a challenge unparalleled in the FCC's history. We collected a thorough record, analyzed our broadcast ownership rules from the ground up, and wrote rules that matched the times. For the first time, we documented the state of the entire industry, empirically analyzed different transactions and their effect on our diversity goals, and, I think most importantly, sought the views of our citizens as to how they obtain their news and public information in an effort to craft rules consistent with the actual rather than theoretical viewing and listening patterns of Americans. I am confident and proud of the job we have done. I believe that our actions will advance our diversity and localism's goals and maintain a vigorously competitive environment. But before concluding, I would like to express my deep appreciation of my colleagues for their tireless effort over these past many months. Commissioners Adelstein and Copps have organized numerous hearings throughout the nation and deserve credit for bringing unprecedented public input to this proceeding. Commissioners Abernathy and Martin have been actively engaged in every step of the process and contributed enormously to the order that's before us today. I admire the genuine commitment of all four of my colleagues to serving the American public in this proceeding. And finally, they are simply not enough words of commendation for the spectacular efforts of the men and women of the Media Bureau. Their dedication and commitment are in the finest traditions of public service. And to them, I and the American people are forever grateful. Commissioner Adelstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a sad day for me and I think for the country. It may be sunny outside, but I'm afraid a dark storm cloud is now looming over the future of the American media. This is the most sweeping and destructive rollback of consumer protections in the history of American broadcasting. The public stands little to gain and everything to lose by slashing the protections that have protected them for decades. This plan is likely to damage the media landscape for generations to come. It threatens to degrade civil discourse and the quality of society's intellectual, cultural, and political life. And for those reasons, I dissent, finding today's order is poor public policy, indefensible under the law, and inimical to the public interest and the health of our democracy. In the end, this order simply makes it easier for existing media giants to gobble up outlets and fortify their already massive market power. It capitulates to too many of the long-standing demands of the media companies that we oversee. This approach, I think, shatters the last vestiges of the consumer protections that weren't eliminated in the 1980s. This decision pulls the teeth out of the remaining rules, leaves the FCC a toothless tiger. As big media companies get bigger, they're likely to broadcast even more homogenized programming that increasingly appeals to the lowest common denominator. It may take a while for the public to feel the full effects of this decision. Consolidation in the media markets could take place over a number of years, just as it did in radio. But people will notice every time a new merger goes through that eliminates a voice in their community. Their anger will flash as people surf through the channels, only to find more sensationalism, more commercialism, more crassness, more violence, more homogenization, and noticeably less serious coverage of news and local events, just as many Americans have warned me they expect to happen if we allow further consolidation. Judging from our record, public opposition is nearly unanimous, from ultra-conservatives to ultra-liberals and virtually everyone in between. We received about 750,000 comments from public in opposition to relaxing our ownership rules, and that was a new record. We've never seen that kind of an outpouring. We've only seen a handful in support. The hundreds of citizens that Commissioner Copps and I heard from directly at field hearings across the country, not one stood up to call for relaxing the rules. Of the thousands of emails I personally received, I saw only one that didn't oppose further media concentration. The American people appear united in believing that media concentration has gone too far already and should go no further. I've heard it said we can't make decision by polls or weighing postcards. I think that's fair enough. But the statute doesn't let us simply dismiss the public's views with a passing reference in a single paragraph, as this item currently does. public is joined by a bipartisan chorus from over 150 members of Congress, organizations from nearly every political stripe, from the NRA to the National Organization for Women, expressed grave doubt about the wisdom of allowing greater consolidation. We heard from artists, academics, media moguls, Republicans, Democrats, Greens, everybody in between. And let me tell you, the Americans we heard from know what they're talking about. This is the media they watch and view every day. They take this very, very personally, and they have been very articulate and substantive in what they have to say. We heard from people who've collectively spent billions of hours watching TV, listening to radio, and reading newspapers. There's no better expert witness than the American people. There's no more objective jury. But today's decision overrides the better judgment of the American people. It instead relies on the reasoning of a handful of powerful media companies who have a vested financial interest. Those who stand to benefit by buying and selling the public airwaves are winning out today over the public. Now, anyone who questions whether consolidation can cause harm need only look to the experience of radio. The most constant refrain I heard from coast to coast was complaints about the homogenization and lack of news coverage on the radio dial in recent years. People begged us not to let happen to television what happened to radio. But the majority didn't heed this concern. By ignoring this history, we may be destined to repeat it. The Supreme Court has said that, quote, promoting the widespread dissemination of information from a multiplicity of sources, end quote, is of the highest order. So safeguarding diversity should not be subject to abstract diversity scenarios or arbitrary decisions that reduce the number of voices people can hear. I don't mean to suggest that bigness is always bad or that free enterprise will always fail the public. Free enterprise serves the public so well in so many ways and is why we have such a wonderful proliferation of outlets and ideas floating through the airwaves today. There's nothing inherently wrong with earning profits from using public property. But when it comes to gaining even greater profits at the expense of the cornerstones of our democracy, we've got to carefully question the effects on the public. Today's rules just don't let the big get bigger. They'll effectively prevent smaller entities from ever breaking in. I would have relaxed the rules more incrementally and shown the public each time how they'd benefit. Since my arrival here 5 years ago, I've approached this proceeding with a constructive frame of mind. I sought to understand the various proposals and their underpinnings and offer my views on their efficacy. Even after others closed in on an approach which I could not get comfortable with, I made reasonable attempts to moderate the proposals which were denied. In the end, it wasn't the process that precluded me from participating in drafting and supporting today's order. It was the substantive direction the item took and the results-driven imposition of bottom-line, bright-line rules ahead of all else. I'm disappointed that a majority of my colleagues could not be persuaded to take a more reasoned, conservative, case-by-case approach. But this is far from over. Congress may prove more responsive to the citizens who passionately plead for the independence of the diversity of their media. To paraphrase Winston Churchill, this is not the end or even the beginning of the end, but just the end of the beginning. Thank you.
Those commissioners voting in favor of the item signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed signify.
The item is adopted. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.
Mass regulation of the mass communication is the end of democracy. Mass deregulation of the mass communication is the end.
And with that, the vote signaling the greatest overhaul of media ownership rules in the country went 3-2. Michael Powell, the chair of the FCC, leading the way. We will go to break. When we come back, we'll be joined by the spokesperson for the FCC, Ken Faree. We'll be joined by one of the dissident commissioners, Michael Copps, as well as one of those who protested in the FCC hearing room. Stay with us.
when he heard he's gonna get into the United Nations. They started it off with a ping pong game, and so that President Nixon gonna do his thing.
Willie Dixon in the news here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, as we talk about the FCC vote that could unleash the largest wave of media consolidation in U.S. history. One of those who was in the hearing room yesterday who was taken out by security was Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Global Exchange. Medea, can you talk about what happened at the end of the vote and why you were protesting?
Well, first of all, let me say, Amy, how difficult it was to even get in that hearing yesterday. We got there the earliest. Our Code Pink group stood online for several hours, and then merely because we were wearing pink, they were so afraid of us, they didn't want to let us in the main room, wanted to stick us in the overflow room when there weren't any people there yet. They took away all our signs. They took away anything that could be that we could maybe hold up as a protest. So they weren't too interested in free speech to begin with. And then after the five commissioners spoke, we got up, and we were told we couldn't shout, so we decided to sing. And we sang Mass Deregulation of the Mass Communication as the End of Democracy. And I think what we saw yesterday was a vote that was a terrible vote, but two heroic commissioners, one who you're going to have on, Michael Copps, and the other, Jonathan Adelstein. And I must say that I was really proud to not only hear them speak, but proud of their defying the head of the commissioner and going around the country and really soliciting input. And it's not many times that we see people in these positions stick their necks out like these two commissioners did. And so for me, while I was extremely upset about the vote yesterday, I am encouraged that we have these two commissioners and we have a number of people in Congress who are willing to go the next step now and try to undo what happened yesterday.
We're also joined by Ken Faree, spokesperson for the Federal Communications Commission, made a presentation yesterday before the vote. How do you see the significance of this vote and what will unfold now?
Yeah, sure. Happy. First of all, I should clarify, I'm actually chief of the bureau, the person that oversaw the staff effort. The staff spent 20 months drafting these proposed rules that were put before the commission yesterday. I am not a spokesperson for the commission per se. As to the changes that were made yesterday, I'm very confident that these were well-balanced, well-thought-through changes that had to be made in light of the growth of media in this country, their number of outlets that are available, the number of sources that are available today are far greater than when those rules were adopted 30 and 40 years ago.
What about, for example, in places like New York and Los Angeles, the new rules meaning a single company can own up to three local TV stations for the first time and to own both a newspaper and TV station, as well as rules expanding the number of markets in which an owner can have up to two stations? How do you address these issues of this unleashing a wave of media consolidation like we've never seen in this country?
What wave it will unleash, I mean, that's all predictive. Some people think it will, some people think it won't. Our challenge here was we're faced with a statute and with several court decisions telling us that we had to be able to justify any restrictions that we impose on the record. So when you talk about a market like New York or Los Angeles with over 20 TV stations in it, if we were to say you can't have three, for instance, we have to be able to explain to a court on what basis we would impose that restriction. Does it cause a competitive harm in the market for one entity to own three? Does it cause a diversity harm in the market? And particularly when you're talking about balancing not only the harms on one hand, there may be incremental losses of diversity from a company owning more than one TV station, But there's also evidence in the record that there are localism gains in the sense that these companies often, when they buy a second or third TV station, do more and better public interest programming, more news programming. The ratings go up, apparently reflecting the fact that they're providing service that the community likes better than it did before the station became part of a group. So there, it's a balance. As all things in public policy are, you can always focus on the harms, but there actually can be some benefits that come too, and it's trying to weigh those two things in a reasoned way that we can justify in court, and surely we will end up in court again, to have rules that are enforceable to prevent the kind of unfettered combinations that you're talking about.
I wanted to get your response to the news conference that was held afterwards by an interesting group of senators, including Republican Senator Trent Lott, and, well, this is Democratic Senator Fritz Hollings of South Carolina.
I think everybody's on notice now that we're in trouble, and the Congress tried to react. We communicated very forcefully with Chairman Powell. It was ignored. It's certainly ignored within the decision now that's come out this morning. So if needs be, yes, there could be a rider on the appropriation bill that no money should be expended by the FCC to administer the Powell rule. That's clear, isn't it? let the contributions begin.
And that was Senator Fritz Hollings of South Carolina. Ken Faree of the FCC, your response.
Well, yeah, of course, we always listen to members of Congress, but we also have to follow the law. And the law, as passed by Congress and signed by the president, requires us every 2 years to engage in this exercise. Indeed, we are 6 months behind on this one. We are about to start the 2004 biennial in about another 6 months. So this is, you know, we have to do what the statute tells us to do. There is no discretion here for the FCC. We could not have waited. We could not have put this off. We had to make a decision.
We're also joined on the phone by Hannah Sassaman, who is a longtime opponent of the media consolidation decision yesterday. Hannah Sassaman is with the Prometheus Radio Project. Your response?
Well, first of all, I'd like to address the point that quality really improves and public interest really improves in local broadcasts when those outlets are acquired by larger companies. The studies that were commissioned by the Federal Communications Commission are often contradicted by other excellent studies, including this one from the Project for Excellence in Journalism, which was funded by the Pew and Columbia Journalism School. Their organization found that TV operators that were owned by smaller companies were twice as likely to rank high on measures of quality, like breadth of topics and sourcing and the balance of viewpoints, than stations owned by the nation's 10 biggest group owners. So I think it's really important to realize that the studies that the FCC commissioned, which were also, again, not released in terms of their methodology and in terms of how they happened until very, very late in the game, those studies are often contradicted by very, very reputable organizations. So it's really difficult to say that that localism is going to be improved by this consolidation push. Many folks believe it's going to really, really, really go down.
You know, the one thing that isn't hard to say, though, is that the ratings go up in every case. So I would think that, at least, you can argue about studies, but ratings, I think, indicate what people like to watch.
I really believe that is one of the biggest problems at the FCC. When someone like Michael Powell says that the market is his religion, when someone like Michael Powell calls the corporations, which he is supposed to regulate, his clients, of course the FCC is going to say that ratings, that the different programs, no matter how bad they are, if they get people watching them, is going to prove that there is localism or that there's good diversity in the content. I really believe that the American public has stated very, very clearly in the over 500,000 comments that is sent in to the Federal Communications Commission that they want localism, that they want diversity. And the coalition, which has been built to fight for these things, for localism, for diversity, for independent media, is not going to stand back and allow the bills that have been proposed in Congress and in the Senate to rot away. We're going to support those bills and support that legislation in order to counter this FCC's very disrespectful push to deregulate. disrespectful of the voices of the American public.
Ken Furey, I wanted to ask a question. The actions are seen as a major victory for media giants like CBS parent Viacom, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, and Tribune Company. All of them have been able to at least temporarily cross some limits of the old rules, and now the lifting of the cap from 35% to 45% will mean they don't have to sell off some of their media empire. Do you see a conflict of interest between a company like Viacom that will profit so handsomely from these rule changes? A conflict of interest between Viacom, their role in lobbying and in paying, giving money to FCC officials like you, up to that report that the Center for Public Integrity put up, FCC officials rack up $2.8 million travel tab with industries they regulate. They refer to Viacom sponsoring 7 trips, costing close to $10,000, spending close to $7,000, bringing you, Ken Furey, FCC Media Bureau Chief, and a top legal advisor to Chairman Michael Powell to a company management conference in March 2002. And here you are, the chief architect of the proposal to overhaul the media ownership rules.
Boy, that was a lot. I'm not sure what to respond to there. Let me start with where you started, which was on the rules. And you point out exactly why this is not a great victory for the media giants. The companies like Viacom were over the old cap. And guess what? They were over the old cap because the old cap was unenforceable, as were all of the other old rules that everybody seems to like so well. When we tried to enforce them, we lost in court. Had we continued to try to enforce them, we would have continued to lose in court. And I'm not sure that would have benefited the American public or anybody, for that matter, other than maybe the big media giants. What we tried to do yesterday was adopt rules that we can defend in court and that we can win on in court that will contribute to a diversity of voices in the market, improve competition within the market, and protect all of the interests that everybody purports to want to have protected here.
But that issue of Viacom, which owns CBS, spending $6,900 to bring you to a company management conference in 2002.
Yeah, we travel to lots of different conferences. This is our way to get out and learn about the industry, tell them about things that are going on in the FCC that affect the industry, but more importantly, they're educational for the staff to go, particularly on technology, to learn about new technologies and how they operate, and to see, in some cases, facilities in use in the field. So it's not uncommon at all. I think the numbers that we're talking about are not out of line with anything that's happened in the past, and you know, this is, I think, pretty routine.
Can I address this quickly?
Yes, go ahead.
Well, that same study by the Center for Public Integrity also showed that you and that others of your staff really didn't come out to advocacy meetings. You didn't come out to advocacy conferences. You didn't come out to public media conferences. You just went to these industry conferences and went. Well, what?
I've done a number of public advocacy things. I did one in Chicago with the minority media owners. I did one in Florida with the public educational government television station people that do public access work.
Well, the FCC defunds or refuses to fund Commissioner Copps's hearings all over the country, and when the number that Ms. Goodman stated is the amount of money that they're spending on sending you to industry conferences, I think that there's quite a bit of disparity there.
Yeah, you're confusing two things, though. We do have a very limited budget here. What we're talking about is when other entities pay for us to go out to see facilities, to get out of our ivory tower here in Washington outside the Beltway and see what's going on in America. That's different than when the commission pays for it. But by the way, when I did the public interest groups, the FCC did pay for it. We didn't ask them to pay the bill.
None of the trips examined were sponsored by consumer groups or individuals, all by the larger corporations like
That's
Viacom.
Right, the FCC paid on the other one.
Well, we're going to go now to Michael Copps, who is one of the dissident commissioners. And I know, Ken Furey, you didn't want to be on with him. Hannah Sassman, thanks very much for being with us as well of the Prometheus Radio Project.
Thank you.
Commissioner Copps, your final comments on this discussion, but more importantly, the mass overhaul of the media ownership rules that took place yesterday, and where you see the movement going from here.
Well, good morning, Amy, and thanks so much for having me on, and thanks for all the good work you have done in trying to help make the American people aware of this issue, and I think you were very successful in doing that, judging from the outpouring of sentiment that we have had. You come out of a day like yesterday with mixed feelings. Obviously, I was disappointed that we didn't carry that vote, even though we didn't expect to going in there. But I also come out with a good deal of hope for a number of reasons. Number one, there are avenues of redress here, from reconsideration petitions that can be presented to the commission, but probably more importantly, congressional avenues of redress. There has already been legislation introduced to reverse some of what was done yesterday. We have a hearing coming up tomorrow morning before the Senate Commerce Committee. Senator McCain, Senator Holling, Senator Dorgan, Senator Lott, and others, all of them have serious questions about the direction that the commission is going, and they want to find out what's the state of play down here and what are our thoughts for the future of the industry. So we have that option. And then there are the courts. I think we can count on the fact that there will be contests in the courts over these rules. But what most enthuses me about the future here is that this has become, thank God, something of a grassroots issue, in spite of the fact that the FCC did not do a very good job in outreach and trying to inform the American people of what was going on, and in spite of the fact that big media until very recently just about ignored this this issue, and only recently has done enough to help tee it up. But it is teed up now. We have 750,000 people writing to the FCC, contacting the FCC. We see very clearly that the only place this is apparently a partisan issue is right here within the commission, because on the Hill it's not partisan. Around the country it's not partisan. It's not Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative, north or south, urban or rural or anything else. It seems to be an all-American grassroots issue.
Senator Holling saying that they would consider attaching a rider to the appropriations bill, cutting off money to the FCC to enforce any of this or to allow this to happen.
Well, that's one option on the appropriations route, and then there's just the normal authorization legislation process where you would just do something specifically, like on the 35% cap. I think something has already been proposed to go back to the 35% cap rather than go ahead with the 45%.
Well, Michael,
there are a range of options there.
Well, we will certainly continue to cover this beginning tomorrow at the hearing in Washington, D.C. in Congress. Thank you very much for being with us. Dissident Commissioner Michael Copps, one of two of the five commissioners who voted against the media ownership rule overhaul that was voted on yesterday. That we are now going to turn after the break to the nurse who was bombed in the attack on the Women's Health Clinic in Birmingham, Alabama, as Eric Rudolph is taken to Birmingham to stand charges. Stay with us.
All right, we're going to fix that technical problem.
Tick-tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, Fox News, breaking news.
Faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
Worked at ABC News, worked at CNN.
To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
General Myron, thank you, sir.
There was never a question raised in the mainstream media about why we should really be going to war, only when we were going to go to war.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An article in the Birmingham News describes his arrival Eric Rudolph was flown to Birmingham, Alabama, arrived at the Jefferson County Jail after 1 p.m. Monday, riding in a red Ford Crown Victoria, followed closely by other cars filled with rifle-wielding agents. Law enforcement snipers on the roof of the nearby Sheridan Birmingham Hotel watched as U.S. Marshals and Jefferson County Sheriff's deputies led Rudolph, wrists and legs shackled, into the back of the jail. Rudolph still wore the orange jumpsuit assigned him at the Cherokee County, North Carolina jail, where he had been held since his Saturday capture. Yes, after the largest manhunt in U.S. history, the man charged with two attacks on women's health clinics, the Atlanta Olympics bombings, and a gay nightclub has been captured. Federal authorities deciding to send him to Birmingham, Alabama, where he will be charged first. It was there one morning, 1998, that a bomb exploded outside the New Woman, All Woman Health Care Clinic. Police officer Robert Sanderson was killed. Nurse Emily Lyons was critically injured. And she joins us in the studio right now. Welcome to Democracy Now! It is very good to have you with us. As you hear that description of Eric Rudolph brought to Birmingham, your thoughts?
Satisfaction that he's been captured and he will stand trial for the destruction and death that he caused in Birmingham.
Can you describe, if you will, and I know it's painful to go back to, but you have done it many, many times, to that day, what happened? Where were you in and around the building?
Okay. I was about 12 feet away from the bomb that day. I was closer to the building than Sandy was. So after the suspected bomber detonated the bomb by remote control from across the street, I woke up about 4 weeks later. Severe pain, and of course, the bomb did deal kill Sandy instantly. It's been a long 5 years of recovery, and the problems associated with that day will never go away.
You were walking into the clinic.
I was at the front door talking with Sandy, according to the witnesses, because I don't remember that day at all, that we were talking, and he motioned me to go back towards the building, and he went over and stood over the flower pot with his nightstick, and then that's when the suspect detonated it.
I don't think most people realize it was a detonated bomb.
Right, it wasn't a timer. He was standing across the street, and he watched what he did to us.
It's an amazing story how he was identified. Can you talk about the medical student?
I don't know who that is. That has been kept very secret.
The medical student who saw him walking away from the clinic when other people's instinct was to come toward it after the bombing, and so got suspicious and left his room, got in a car, and started to follow the man who had gotten into a pickup truck. And ultimately, he got his license plate, and that was the ultimate tracking of Eric Rudolph.
Yes. The truck was at a McDonald's several miles away, and fortunately, the witness saw him coming out of the woods and went to the truck, and that's how he found out the tag number.
Let's talk about who Eric Rudolph is. Spent part of his youth living with the Army of God and with Christian Identity, a white supremacist religion, anti-gay, anti-Semitic, anti-foreigner. For years, the survivalist Army veteran hid deep in the forests of Appalachia from police who were equipped with bloodhounds and infrared-equipped helicopters and motion detectors. It's believed he received some help from people in the community or perhaps a member of his family. They sold T-shirts saying, "Run, Rudolph, run," and slipped pictures of dead fetuses on the cars of FBI and media joining the chase. We're also joined by Ann Glazier, who's director of Planned Parenthood Security. Though in both cases, neither of the women's health clinics that were bombed were Planned Parenthood facilities, how has Eric Rudolph affected these clinics, hundreds of Planned Parenthood clinics around the country, Ann?
I think the
primary effect that it's had is to reinforce our ideas about security, that we need to have security and we need to offer that as a service exactly the way that we offer health services to women. And I think even with the capture of Rudolph, one of the things that we also have this year is the trial and sentencing of James Kopp, who assassinated Dr. Slepian in Buffalo. And both of those cases, I think, point to that we absolutely have to have security at our facilities, but also that we know how to do this, and that we have some good ideas for law enforcement, and that we have to take part in keeping ourselves safe just as an average citizen has to do. And I think that's the message we get again from his from Rudolph's capture by local law enforcement, his recognition by another law enforcement agency, and then the subsequent.
It's interesting that Eric Rudolph, as well as Kopp, the man who was in, who was killed, who was convicted of
yes.
the killing of the Dr. Slepian, were caught under the Ashcroft administration, if you will. Ashcroft, head of the Justice Department, his own views very clear, has once said that if he could accomplish one thing in his life, it would be to end abortion in this country. This weekend, he said, Attorney General John Ashcroft, that we have caught the most notorious American fugitive on the FBI's most wanted list. He has been captured and will face American justice. The American people, most importantly, the victims of these terrorist attacks, can rest easier. Do you rest easier, Emily?
I'm sorry.
Emily.
Ever since I came home, I've been resting easy. Other than the fact that he was still out there and nobody had found him yet, there was always the possibility he could hurt someone else. But now that we know that he can't hurt anyone else now.
You always believed he was alive?
I always believed, yes, and I believed he was still in the area there.
Ultimately, what happened to you? What were your injuries?
I lost my left eye. It damaged my right eye, so I have limited vision. It broke the right side of my face, first, second, and third degree burns on the front of my body. Broke my left leg. It destroyed arteries in my left leg that had to be rebuilt. Tore the muscle and skin off the front of my legs. Hole in my abdomen. My intestines were hanging out, as they said. Messed up my predominant hand and ruptured an eardrum. A few other things, but that's the big ones.
And Glazier, that he's been captured now during this time.
I don't rest easier. I'm very relieved that Rudolph has been captured, and I'm very relieved that Kopp has been sentenced. But the unfortunate message that we've had to experience is that someone will try to take their place, and that's what my concern is. And to go back for a minute, the capture and the bringing to justice of both of these people was a process that was started way before the Ashcroft Bush administration. And one of the things that happened during that period was a lot of people were educated about how much of a criminal act this is, that it is terrorism, that it's designed to make people afraid. I think the most amazing thing about Emily's story is that she never gave up. She absolutely refused to be terrorized, refused to be intimidated, and developed her message in her own way, but never was hit under the bed, so to speak, and which is the message of terrorism. You can't go anywhere, you can't do anything.
In addition to Emily Lyons, the nurse who was critically injured by the bombing of the Women's Health Clinic in Birmingham, Alabama, the first attack that Eric Rudolph will be tried for, and Ann Glazer, Director of Planned Parenthood Security, were joined on the phone by Chip Berlay, Senior Analyst at Political Research Associates, an independent center that studies authoritarian and other oppressive movements and institutions and trends, wrote a book called Right-Wing Populism in America. We've heard the descriptions of Eric Rudolph. He was a white supremacist survivalist. Can you tell us more?
Well, he was definitely influenced by Christian Identity, which explains the targeting, because I was just looking at some Christian Identity materials yesterday and today, looking at articles about abortion, and from the Christian Identity point of view, the racist version of Christian Identity, abortion is the extinguishing of the white race. So it's a very racist application of anti-abortion rhetoric. They also see gays and lesbians as sinful. They also are against race mixing and internationalism and globalism, thus the Olympics. And I think people need to really face the racism and sexism and homophobia in this alleged series of acts, because too many people are dismissing Eric Rudolph as some kind of nut when he really comes out of a political milieu that believes in killing its political adversaries as the carrying out the will of God.
It's interesting. We're going to have the head of Christian Coalition on today as well, but they pulled out. They said they didn't support what Eric Rudolph had done, and we asked them to come on to talk about that. But in the end, they said they didn't want to. Your thoughts on that, Chip?
Well, if people do need to be careful about drawing distinctions, Eric Rudolph comes out of Christian Identity, which is really a race-hate theology in its most virulent form. Many of the people who have attacked abortion clinics and reproductive rights centers around the country are part of a militant Christian evangelical sector that's very small, and I don't doubt that the Christian Coalition opposes acts of violence, but of course they then portray abortion providers in a way that leads some people to think that it might be appropriate to carry out acts of violence. So even though we're looking at three different sectors here, the Christian Coalition is a relatively mainstream conservative evangelical group. Christian Dominionists who kill abortion providers tend to come out of a much smaller doctrinaire section, often associated with Christian Reconstructionism. Christian Identity, which is a race-hate theology, you really make those distinctions, but then you have to say that they're all creating an environment in which women's health is at risk.
I'm going to give the final word to Emily Lyons in New York just for a few days and then headed back home to Birmingham. Will you be at the trial of Eric Rudolph?
Yes. Since it will be in Birmingham, I should be able to be easy to access the trial, and as much as I can tolerate sitting there, I will.
Well, I thank you very much for being with us, Emily Lyons, the nurse critically injured in the attack on the Women's Health Clinic in Birmingham, and Ann Glazier, head of Planned Parenthood Security, Chip Relay with Political Research Associates. And that does it for our program. If you'd like a copy of the show, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Our website, where you can see the program video and audio streaming and get contact information, is www.democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Rybel, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer, with help from Rich Kim, and happy, very happy birthday to Angie Karen. Again, our email address, mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. And if you want to get a copy of today's show, 1-800-881-2359. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hatred was immediate, yeah, the vengeance was divine.